Again, this is lecture two. So today, a lot of you already know what I'm going to talk about today, certainly the grad students. So I'm going to cover, go through the generalized axioms. Actually, here we have it here. So generalized preparations, measurements, and transformations. Then we'll look a bit carefully at the idea of using looking at measurement as a transformation itself and how we can fit that into our axiomatic structure. And then, time permitting, we'll discuss a bit more about entanglement. So, can everyone in the class hear me okay? Okay, good. So now I've got to skip ahead to... So last class we covered the standard axioms, and then we started discussing the generalized axioms, which describe the scenario where you don't have kind of the most ideal setup possible that's allowed by the laws of quantum mechanics. So your states might be mixed, your measurements might not be PVMs, and your transformations might not be unitary operators. So just to briefly cover what we did at the end of last class, there were two ways to construct mixed states. One was by just taking mixtures or convex combinations of pure states. And so I'll skip through that. And so here's a discrete versus a continuous way to do that. And the other scenario was where you imagine having some generally entangled state across two systems, A and B, and then you trace out the second system, and you're left with a mixed state on system B. And there's a consistency check for determining what the form of that reduction has to be. And that's the partial trace, which applies for arbitrary operators on the joint Hilbert space. And it's given by that rule. And then our generalized axiom one was that I forgot to change this again, but it's supposed to be the preparation of a system is describable by a positive semi-definite operator rho, subject to the normalization trace rho is 1. And then we had some discussion about pure versus mixed states and purifications. Oops. So now we're going to consider the same thing in the context of measurements. So remember from in the standard axioms, a measurement is just a self-adjoint operator. And what was really fundamental about that was when you look at its spectral decomposition, you have a sum over the projectors onto the distinct eigenspaces, distinguishable by the eigenvalue. And so that primitive object is called a PVM, which is just the set of orthogonal projectors that sum to identity. And now there are two ways that we can get a more general type of measurement in quantum mechanics. One is by considering just convex combinations of these PVM measurements, and the other is by looking at what happens when you have an extended system, so a composite system, and you perform a PVM on the composite system and then take a partial trace to see what the effective action of that measurement is on the system of interest. So first, the easy case, which is the case of convex combinations. So imagine you have two different PVMs, one without a tilde and one with a tilde. Each of these are, I think for simplicity, I'm assuming they're maximal and non-degenerate. And so we have a Hilbert space with dimension d, and of course they each sum to 1 with usual orthogonality rules. But an element from the first PVM won't necessarily be orthogonal to an element from the second PVM. So you can imagine a physical procedure where you have some device that prepares, that does measurement. You know, you're putting systems into a measurement device. It kind of randomly decides whether it's going to do measurement 1 or measurement 2, the untilded or the tilded measurement. And it does each of those with a certain probability or relative frequency. The way you would describe that situation is that you have probability of outcome I, which is given by the probability of that measurement times the usual Born rule. And the probability of outcome J is the probability of the tilde measurement multiplied by the usual Born rule. So now let's just redefine these rescaled projectors as operators E sub nu, where we let nu index from 1 to 2D, and the first D elements of nu are I, and the second D elements are index, the index set J. And then we have an effective description of the measurement, which is just the probability of outcome nu is given by the trace of this operator e nu against the preparation. And then it's easy to see that these new operators have to both sum to identity, and my LaTeX didn't work out there. Each one has to be, this is supposed to say, condition two there is that it's a non-negative operator for every nu. And so the key point is that because of the rescaling factor p here, which is when it's a non-trivial probability, so it's somewhere within the interval 0, 1, then this isn't a projector. So it doesn't square to give itself again. So the other way we can construct a kind of non-standard measurement or generalized measurement is considering two Hilbert spaces and a joint measurement on the two Hilbert spaces. So in this case, we're going to have a normal kind of standard axiom PVM acting on the composite system. And so it's an orthogonal set of projectors, which sum to identity. And the Greek index runs over the dimension of the composite Hilbert space, which is m times n. So I guess implicitly here, I've assumed that the dimension of HA is m and the dimension of HB is n. So then we can calculate the probability of outcome nu, and it's just the usual Born rule. And we can write everything out in terms of some orthonormal basis for the composite system space, where I've defined what these matrix elements are here. And then we again have this type of structure where the probability of outcome nu is describable by some operator e nu multiplied against the reduced state on system A. And you can easily check that these new operators we've defined here in this way, here I'm defining them kind of component-wise in terms of their matrix elements, they have to sum to identity and they have to be non-negative for every nu. So it's the same condition we saw previously. And again, notice that these operator elements are not necessarily orthogonal, and that's one of the key differences with the PVM. And the number of elements can be much larger than the Hilbert space dimension. In fact, you can actually form a continuous set of such operators. We'll see that a bit later. So there's a second paradigm within this second paradigm of doing projective measurements on a composite system. So in this last case, I considered that you did a projective measurement that spanned the joint Hilbert space. But now a more important, actually, a more physically relevant example that pertains to how you like to do ideal measurements is you imagine that the second system is prepared in some known state. And then what you do is you have, you know, the initial, this is the system you want to measure, and this is the second system prepared in some known state, and then you apply some unitary operator on the joint system, which involves some controlled interaction. So you get kind of the exact interaction you want. And then you're going to do a measurement on this output state, which is on the composite Hilbert space, but the measurement's going to be of a special form. Namely, it's going to be a measurement just on system B. And so this is exactly what you want to do when you're performing a measurement with an apparatus. So you think of system A as some elementary particle, and system B as being your apparatus. And then the idea is you want the apparatus to respond in a particular way to different possible input states. And then you perform a measurement on the apparatus, and by looking at what state the apparatus is in, you infer what state the system was in prior to measurement. So this way, not only do you gain information about the state A via the Born rule, but you also can then say something about the state of system, the state of system A after the measurement. So the idea is you can do some arbitrary destructive measurement on system B, but because of the way you've correlated the two systems, you can infer properties of system A. And so this was exactly the scenario that von Neumann described that we saw last class in terms of this Compton experiment, where you allowed two particles to interact via some known scattering process. And then you do some, say, destructive measurement of particle A. And then in that way, you know something about the final state of particle B. So how do we represent this in terms of some effective measurement operator on system A alone? Well, the key is to imagine the PVM to be of this form. So you have essentially identity on system A, which means you do nothing on system A, and you're performing a PVM on system B. So let U be this arbitrary unitary operator, and then our probability of some outcome M, where M was the index on the PVM in the previous slide, is describable in this way. So we have the measurement is I do nothing on system A, perform some possibly destructive measurement on system B, in the sense that you don't really care about what the final state is of system B. And then U is the coupling that produced the correlations you wanted. And then we can just, you know, do some algebra. And at the end of the day, we get this description again, where this is describable in terms of some effective operator E against rho in a Born rule type expression, where here EM is defined in this way, where I haven't defined A dagger and AM. So, well, these are defined implicitly. I guess you'll have to, later on, you'll see what they are. They end up being these things called Krauss operators, which I'll discuss in a few moments. And so again, it turns out that these operators satisfy the same conditions, namely that they're element-wise, each one is non-negative, and they sum to identity. So when we construct these more complex measurement scenarios, we find the same properties for the effective description. And so that leads us to kind of a tentative proposition, which is that first let's define what we mean by a POVM. So here this is defined just in the discrete case. I'll define the continuous case later, but there's a lot of kind of overhead that isn't so obvious to parse. So let's just look at the discrete case because it's a lot easier. So a discrete positive operator valued measure, or POVM, is a set of operators that satisfy this non-negativity condition, and they sum to unity. So as you can imagine, the non-negativity is going to guarantee that you have, when you put it into the trace rule, you're going to get some non-negative number. And that sum to identity guarantees those numbers add to 1, which makes them probabilities. And so then we can have a generalized axiom 2. In the case of a discrete measurement, and so any measurement procedure with discrete outcomes is represented by a discrete POVM, and the probability is given by this generalized Born rule. Why do I call this Neumark's theorem? Sorry, let's ignore the title. We'll get to Neumark's theorem later. Did you have a question about him?
Well, just these positive operator value measures, like in the case of the example with the scattering experiment or the last one where you can scatter your line.
Right.
Those were all, when you're describing the measurements in this kind of composite space, they were all projector value measurements.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when you kind of traced out.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so you're touching on, maybe you're, I don't, tell me if this is where you're going. The idea is you have this kind of superfluous description almost, because at the end of the day, all you really need is the PVM model of measurements, and as long as you consider adding some extra Hilbert space, then you're in shape. You can just use the standard axioms. So that approach, also which also applies for transformations and for states, is called the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space. Which is to say, we don't need to worry about POVMs, we don't need to worry about, which you'll see, our CP maps in a moment. The idea is that really we can always think about quantum mechanics as whenever we have some noisy or non-ideal description, it's because there's really what's going on is there's some pure state and some PVM measurement and some unitary process. So there's kind of these two schools of thought. One is that we should take as the primitives the POVMs and the density operators and the CP maps. And the other school of thought, which is called the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, which I think is actually supposed to be kind of a sarcastic way to makes fun of the idea, but I'm not entirely sure, because I was reading actually last night that it was Raymond, what's John Smolin from IBM apparently dubbed this term, which he is apparently an advocate. He believes it, so I don't know why he'd call it that if he was making fun of it. But well, calling it a church makes it seem kind of like it's this, you know. So I'm, yes. Yeah. Yes, I agree with you. And so there's actually, so we can have, this is a point of kind of interpretational discussion, because it turns out if you're kind of a many worlds person, where you take the quantum state to be this ontological object, and we'll get into that next week, then you want to believe the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, because you want to say that those are the fundamental properties of the world. So if I ever have one of these effective descriptions, then what's really going on is what's happening with these actual properties, which you are supposing that quantum states are properties. And so you're kind of wed to the view of the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space. But for people who kind of are more epistemic or operational predisposition, the idea is that quantum states aren't ontological, that they're just these effective objects which give us information about either some hidden variables or the absence of any reality at all, and we'll hear about that from Chris Fuchs later. But so for them, that's why the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space is kind of silly, is because it's promoting the primitives, it's promoting pure states to be primitives, which they don't shouldn't be. So, but while I don't believe in many worlds, I still think that they should be thought of as primitives. And I'll explain why later in the class. And so basically I like emphasizing how all you need are the ideal axioms. And I actually compare it to, I mean, if you're thinking about doing like classical mechanics, you know, Hamilton's laws give you conservative evolution. But if you want to describe friction, you have to kind of put in terms by hand that depend on the velocity in your equations of motion. And so for me, it's similar in the sense that you would say, well, if I have a noisier friction, a situation with friction, then I need this friction-dependent term, which doesn't come from Hamilton's equations of the system alone. And so you would take as kind of fundamental or axiomatic a description with this dissipative term. Whereas really, you can imagine dissipation as arising from describing the Hamiltonian system of the environment or whatever the surfaces you're rolling on. And so anyways, these are all things to consider, but we can get into that a bit more later. Okay, so the title of this slide is wrong. This is just axiom two. So I'm going to kind of briefly touch on how to describe the continuous case, because the case of continuous POVMs is relevant not just for infinite dimensional Hilbert space, but also finite dimensional Hilbert space. So there's a little bit of measure theory and other things that go into this, which makes it a bit heavy-handed, but let me just go through it for those of you for whom this will be easily digestible. So we have to start by talking about some non-empty set of events, omega, and F is the sigma algebra of subsets of omega, and then this pair gives you a measure space. And then really all that's, I mean, this is really all that's going on is you can think of omega as a set of possible outcomes where you have a continuous set of outcomes, which is certainly the case if you're measuring something like position. And F is just the measurable subset, so say intervals on the real line. So is the position within this interval of the real line? And then you can come up with a more general definition of a POVM, which actually tells you why the concept has this kind of heavy-handed name of being a measure, an operator-valued measure. And so it's a map from the sigma algebra to linear operators, which is constrained by the properties that for any element of the sigma algebra, you have to have a non-negative operator. For the entire set, the operator should be identity. And so this gives you your probabilities, basically, and this gives you that the probabilities add to one again. And then the technical condition on the way in which you add up the operators associated with disjoint sequences. So okay, I should probably skip this slide, but let me just go through it quickly for those of you whom this this is something you're familiar with. So the point is here that under a special case where these operator value measures square to themselves, then you recover a continuous PVM. So when I describe PVMs under the standard axioms, I didn't discuss the continuous case. But here it falls out of the POVM definition as a special case. And then you can restate the PVM rigorously in terms of continuous sets. And then I'm not going to go through it, but I'll just get to the next slide where I describe kind of how to make sense of it in practice, which is that any measurement procedure, and this is our generalized axiom two now, we're not restricted to discrete cases, is that you have some POVM and you have some preparation rho, then the probability of X is the trace of, again, it's this Born type rule of the operator against rho, where the way to parse that is you can think of outcome X as, again, some question of the form, is this continuous variable that I'm describing within some fixed interval, with some finite measure, say on the real line. So that's how you make sense of a position measurement within this formulation. Well, so okay, I don't know precisely how to answer this. I think Gleason's theorem may be relevant to answering your question. Actually, Cosman's nodding, so Cosman, can you give a better answer than I can to this? Yeah, so under certain assumptions, you can deduce it. So what we saw, so I gave you the axiom kind of before really convincing you that that's the right way to do it. So we built up examples that gave us operators, POVMs that satisfied, you know, these properties. But one thing that was missing from that is, well, now does every possible POVM I can construct correspond to something I can actually do using the standard axioms? And this is something that's answered by Neumark's theorem. So again, this is stated in the continuous language, but the discrete case can be stated, kind of arises as a special case. And the point is that for any POVM you can define on the Hilbert space, there exists some PVM acting on an extended Hilbert space and some initial state of that ancillary Hilbert space such that the statistics of that POVM can be obtained by the statistics of the Born rule. And actually, an even stronger statement is possible, which is that the PVM can always take this form, which means that this is the scenario I described here, which is that you imagine a unitary coupling system A and system B, and then just doing the PVM on system B alone. So you can think of any POVM as being realizable in this idealized way where you couple two systems, measure the second system, and then leave the first system essentially untouched. So you can say something about its state after measurement. So remember we looked at density operators, and I quickly glanced over this at the start of the talk. We saw that the set of density operators that were constructed by convex combinations of pure states and the set of density operators you got by considering some entangled pure state on a composite Hilbert space and then tracing out, that those two were mathematically and operationally indistinguishable. So this isn't true for measurements. So, and now this is my terminology, just like they called density operators that were given by convex combinations proper, density operators obtained by partial trace improper, you can extend that terminology to measurements, and you can talk about a proper POVM as one obtained by convex combinations of PVMs. And similarly, an improper one is one obtained via this Neumark type theorem. Now we know that proper POVMs must be at least a subset of improper POVMs because any POVM can be expressed via this dilation. But the point is they're a strict subset, which means that, and I'll show you an example of one in a moment, which means that there are some POVM measurements which require access to a larger Hilbert space. So the difference there is that if you give me some density operator and say, go prepare this in the lab, I'm going to be able to find some system which spits out different pure states on that Hilbert space and just take convex combinations and build up any density operator you want. But if you say, go do this POVM in the lab, it might not be the case that I can just do different PVM measurements with random combinations and implement that POVM. Some POVMs require me to have access to some additional quantum system that I can couple my system to and then perform a PVM on that joint system. So as you know, Raymond will tell you, that's a harder task. So the point is there's an operational distinction which actually is very relevant to practical implementation for these improper POVMs. So an example of an improper POVM, which is actually the simplest POVM you can construct that's not a PVM, is the so-called trine measurement, which is just defined on a qubit or a two-level system. And so you define three unit vectors which form kind of an equiangular set on a circle. You embed that in the block sphere, and you define, you take the Pauli operators along those directions, and you consider the eigenstates of those Pauli operators. And then you define operators E sub nu as 2/3 times the plus one eigenstate of those Pauli operators. So this is called the trine measurement. And as I mentioned, it's the smallest POVM that's not a PVM. And the point is that you cannot do this in the lab by just doing, you know, Pauli measurements and taking random combinations of them. Okay, you guys are much quieter than last class, so I'm going to encourage you to ask questions, okay? If there's something you don't understand, because basically I'm covering in two lectures here stuff that I usually cover in the course of a month in my graduate course on open quantum systems. And the reason for that is I want to kind of de-emphasize the mathematical aspects and emphasize instead the conceptual aspects. So please make sure you understand what's going on. Yeah.
When you were first talking about the POVM, you mentioned that the kind of interaction with system B to the endpoint system A was a method of producing system A that you wanted. So it was a control, like a control recursion device.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this ties into what you were asking about on Tuesday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, yeah, okay, so I think I have a better answer than I had on Tuesday, which is it boils down to, and this is going to be difficult to kind of parse rigorously, does the controlling system have quantum properties or not? So, you know, can I just make a machine which is purely classical, which does the job by controlling my system? Or does it have to have quantum properties? And if it has to have quantum properties, then it's harder to do. And now what exactly I mean, but how do you tell? That's a whole other issue, so I don't know if I can get into that. But I suspect that there would be a kind of a concise way to answer that if you thought about it enough. Okay, I suspect the answer is no, but it's not clear to me how to. I mean, so what you want to think about is you want to say, okay, I'm doing some proper POVM, and I'm doing it because I have some dice in the lab, and I'm rolling them and deciding which measurement, which button to push on the machine that does this PVM versus that PVM. And now, I'm saying that's conceptually different than coupling the system to some quantum system and doing a joint measurement on the two. But you want to say, well, look, I'm a quantum system. The dice are a quantum system. When I look at the dice and do a measurement, I'm doing some PVM on the dice plus measurement. And so in a sense, it's really, it requires extra. Yeah. So I guess the point is that, yes, that's always true, strictly speaking, but it must be that there's a simplified expression that arises, that there's no kind of the coherence is irrelevant. In this. So I can look at the dice and apply the measurement, and I don't need to have access to any coherence of the dice system. I'm hoping Osama has a better answer than me, because I don't want to give that up. Yeah, Osama? I see what you mean. Yes, I guess the question is the reproducibility of the measurement. So in all these things quantum mechanical, whenever you claim you've done something, it's never the case that you can do it once and confirm it. So you have to do it again and again and accumulate statistics, because Born's rule, you know, you compare quantum mechanics to the relative frequency of outcomes. So if you just have one outcome, you're not really confirming or disproving anything. And I guess the point about the coherence is that if you don't have kind of coherent control of the system, then you won't be able to reproduce the same quantum state with the same relative phase each time. And then you won't be able to do certain POVMs, which you would be able to do if you could prepare this exact same quantum superposition each time in the ancillary system. So I think the answer would boil down to something like that, is that doing that POVM such that you get statistical confirmation that you've done it requires having, you know, some initial state of the ancillary system, which is prepared in a controlled way. And if that isn't controlled, then you lose coherence information, and that restricts the set of possible measurements you can do. I think, does that sound right, Osama? So I think that's probably the answer, but I'd probably have to think about it a bit more. Church of Engineering or something like that.
You said that they were equivalent notions, that but if you have POVMs that are not POVMs, then now POVM is an additional kind of extra ingredient.
But any improper POVM is equivalent to a PVM on the larger space. Convex combinations, yes. And those would require you to have this extra resource which you coherently control to implement. Yes, on the bigger space, they're PVMs, yeah. The key point was whether or not the initial state, when you extend the PVM, your PVM is on an extended system, and what I was arguing was that the initial state of that second system has to be controlled. if it's not controlled, you can't necessarily do what you wanted to do if this isn't the state you wanted. Okay, good. Thanks for those questions. Those are very good. So the third thing we want to consider is generalized transformations. So we saw in the standard case, we just have unitary operators describing the way a system transforms, except for the measurement scenario. And now, again, there's two ways we can think about constructing generalized transformations. We can see, well, what happens if we take convex combinations of unitaries, and what happens if we consider a unitary acting on some extended Hilbert space, which we then trace out. So again, this is just exactly the same procedure as before. We just define an operation lambda, which is given by a convex combination of unitaries, by which I just mean a probabilistic combination. And then, obviously, this map is non-unitary, which, by the way, sometimes you hear people in talks, people who are not quantum information theorists will say things like, you can't have non-unitary transformations in quantum mechanics. Well, that's not true. What you can't have is non-linear transformations in quantum mechanics. So you can have non-unitary transformations, and this is an example of one. One thing you note right away is that it preserves the trace of the input state. So that's kind of trivially true by the cyclic property of the trace. And the other thing you see by convexity is that the output state will be a positive semi-definite operator. So in other words, because each output state here, rho sub j, is a positive operator, assuming the input state is a positive operator, and we're just taking convex combinations of positive operators, which guarantees that the resulting operator will be positive. So the terminology is that we call a map which preserves, which takes positive operators to positive operators, and here I'm being sloppy, I'm using positive to mean positive semi-definite, but that's kind of standard the way everyone talks about it. And then we call the map positive if it has that property. So the other thing you can do is act on a larger Hilbert space. And then we have some map lambda, which is parameterized by T. The previous one was as well. I don't know if I put it down there. And then you just have some arbitrary initial system state, I mean ancillary state, and some arbitrary initial state. Well, here I've restricted this to be pure, but we'll deal with that in a second. We apply a unitary which acts on HA tensor HB. And then we trace over system B to get an effective map that just acts on rho A and returns some new operator rho A at time T. So here I've implicitly on the right-hand side defined operators A sub K to be this. Now notice what's going on here. This is a bit subtle. U is an operator acting on HA tensor HB. This state 0 is just in HB. So what that means is that when you're taking, this isn't the normal expectation value which returns a scalar. This is an expectation, well, actually not really an a transition element. So normally this would be a transition matrix element, which would be a scalar. But this returns an operator, because we're only taking the expectation with respect to vectors in the second Hilbert space. So this is some linear operator acting on HA. So now if the environment is a mixed state, then we just take convex combinations of everything and it goes through, because the trace is linear. So I know for any mixed state rho, I can always write it as a convex combination of pure states, and then I can just act like this on each of the elements of that convex combination, and then add them convexly at the end. So notice that I emphasized that the state has to be uncorrelated. So this means it has this tensor product form, and that's a stronger condition than being unentangled. So being unentangled is not enough for this, the results I'm about to tell you. So it's easy to see that this map preserves the trace of the output state just by evaluating this expression. And because it holds for any rho A, any input state, we get this condition on these operators AK. So the operators AK were just some arbitrary linear operators. And now I'm telling you they satisfy a constraint, which is this. And then you can also see, although I don't really spell it out here, that the final state, rho A at time t, is going to be positive. So let me introduce some terminology. When you have a map of this form, which is, satisfies this constraint, it's called a Krauss decomposition or an operator sum decomposition for the map lambda. And we call these linear operators A sub k Krauss operators. So this is all very fundamental to describing kind of open system conditions. So, I mean, this has been studied much more in the past 20 or 30 years because it's only really in the past 20 or 30 years that experimentalists can go in the lab, isolate individual systems, and apply a transformation, a controlled transformation to them, and then repeat that in a highly controlled way. Now, of course, it's not perfect, the control, and so you don't have a unitary operation describing that evolution, but something slightly more complicated is happening because you have environmental noise and the system you're trying to control couples to other systems. The control mechanisms aren't perfect, and so you want to be able to describe how your system transformed using this generalized formalism. And you can do procedures called tomography to verify exactly what happened. So just some more terminology. Any linear map that takes linear operators to linear operators is called a superoperator. And any superoperator representing some dynamical transformation on the space of quantum states is called a quantum dynamical map. So some people use these terms interchangeably. So now we know from the situations we've built up, the two ways in which we've gotten this generalized transformation, we can look at what are the properties that those things we've built up satisfy. And so one is that in both situations we have a map that's convex linear. In both cases we have a map that's completely positive. Now I showed you that the map was positive, or motivated it at least, and it turns out that a stronger condition holds called complete positivity, which is a little more subtle to show. So I'm not going to show you that, but what it basically means is that if you append, your map is completely positive if when lambda is applied to rho, the output is positive. And when you take lambda tensor sum identity transformation applied to an arbitrary input state on A tensor B, then the resulting state on A tensor B is still positive. So the map is completely positive if when you extend it in this way, it still is well behaved and gives you a positive operator. So basically, the reason why you want to impose that condition is you want to say, I don't just want my map to act positively on the input state, but I want to imagine the Church of the larger Hilbert space where the map I'm looking at is acting on part of some entangled state, and I want the output state to still be a well-defined density operator. Yep?
Can you explain more what you mean by completely uncorrelated?
Where do I say that? Oh, at bottom point two. So it comes down to here. The way in which I define these operators was by assuming that the initial state had this product form. And that means it's uncorrelated. So in other words, I can have any state here and I can have any other state here and there's no relationship between them. Now, as you will see later in the lecture and throughout the course, in quantum mechanics, you can have correlations that are stronger than classical ones, and those arise because of something called entanglement. So what I'm saying here is just that if you consider the action of rho, so basically the problem is this. If you have a state of this form, and so it's a probabilistic combination. So this is a density operator associated with system A, and this is a density operator associated with system B. And now there's some variation in the possible input states, and they co-vary, so they're correlated. Now this is not an entangled state, but it's a correlated state. And I have some unitary acting on the combined system. And what happens is when I try to write down an effective description. Which acts only on some row A. Okay, so this is taking this reduced state, so I just trace over system B and I want to know what the action is. The problem is I won't be able to model this in its full generality with a linear map. Okay, and the reason why is because suppose what this unitary is doing is it's saying apply one transformation to row A if row B is in this state, and apply a different transformation if row B is in some other state. So the effective transformation on row A is non-linearly depending on its input state. And so if you have any correlations like that, you can't get a linear transformation. And actually, so there's some interesting work on that where people worry about, and a lot of people, and this, by the way, is another reason why kind of my personal critique of the taking the generalized axioms as primitives is because when you look at transformations, what we're going to find in about two slides is that, you know, the generalized axiom is that transformations are given by linear maps satisfying these properties. But I can go in the lab and certainly design something that does this. Or I can ask Raymond to, or Osama. So the point is you can do these kinds of things in the lab, which have a perfectly valid linear description in the larger Hilbert space, but have some nonlinear description in the reduced Hilbert space. Which means to me that, and I don't know if this is an airtight argument, but it's kind of one of the things that motivates me to reject the view, is that when I want to posit that CP maps are my most general transformation, I'm missing out on some things I can do that I can describe in the Church of Larger Hilbert space, but I can't describe with the generalized axioms. And so I don't know if that argument just has some problems, or if it is a kind of a knockdown argument. But what I do know is that a lot of people who work on foundations, for example, don't even know that you can do something nonlinear with this kind of process. People just take it for granted that CP maps are the most general thing you can do. Actually, we did an experiment at MIT where we showed that the effective description of our transformation was some nonlinear transformation. And people told us we did the experiment wrong. And really what we figured out is that this is what was going on. We had this correlation in the state preparation. Yeah, Adam? Well, the very idea of correlation requires some notion of variation. So if if I toss a coin and you toss a coin and we do it once and we both get heads, are you going to say they're correlated? Well, no. You have to do it many times and see a co-variation in the results to say that there's some kind of correlation. And so the point is that if you have a tensor product structure without this kind of a sum, if I do measurements on A and B separately, I'll get random outcomes that are unrelated to each other, if there is any variation at all. But if I have this kind of a setup, then I can make it so that whenever you get, up for B, you get up for A, and whenever you get down for B, you get down for A. And the only way to build up a state which will do that for you is a state with this kind of non-trivial convex combination. Okay, so I just explained point one. So complete positivity implies positivity, but the converse is not true. And then a simple example of a map which is positive but not completely positive is this partial transpose map, which I was mentioned in passing. So let's define a completely positive map to be a superoperator satisfying conditions 1 and 2, and a completely positive trace-preserving map to be one that satisfies conditions 1 through 3. So just to remind you, the difference is 3 is this condition of trace-preserving. So this is going to be important because when we want to describe measurements as transformations, we're going to drop condition 3. And you'll see why. So just some handy theorems. Basically, a superoperator is a CPTP map if and only if it admits an operator sum decomposition. And then the theorem you want to know is the Steinspring dilation theorem, which is that if I have some CPTP map, you pick it out of a mathematical hat, right? You just build one mathematically, then Steinspring tells us that I can always realize that as some unitary acting on an extended Hilbert space. So again, we have this recurring theme where the church of larger Hilbert space is completely sufficient. So then we can formulate a generalized axiom 4, which is that over any finite time, the dynamical transformation of a quantum system is described by a completely positive trace-preserving map. And then some useful results is that the maximum number of operators you would need in the Krauss sum is d squared if the Hilbert space dimension is d. Steinspring's representation is not unique in the sense that it's unique up to some unspecified unitary on the Ancilla system. So what that means is it's a one-to-many relation between the super operator maps and the dilated unitaries. So there's many dilated unitaries which give you the same effective description. And so there's a bound on the practical size of the Ancilla system you need to implement any CP map. So then again, we can then, this is something that's kind of a pet thing for me. I don't know if it's that important, but you can distinguish proper and improper CPTP maps depending on whether or not they can be realized via convex combination of unitary operators. And so useful definition is that a CPTP map is unital if it maps the identity operator to the identity operator. This implies a condition on the Krauss operators. This condition is different than the condition you saw before. The condition you saw before, the adjoint operation was on the first element of the product, and now it's on the second element. So it's a distinct condition. So the point is, if you construct a CPTP map via taking convex combinations of unitaries, then that map will be unital. Okay, that should be pretty obvious because any unitary acting on the identity gives you the identity. The convex combination of the identity operator is just the identity operator. But if there are non-unital maps, so an example is spontaneous decay of an atom. So if I start out in a uniform superposition of each of its eigenstates, and then it decays, it's going to be left in one of those eigenstates. So I've gone for transformations taking me from identity to a particular eigenstate, the ground state. So the point is that there are some CPTP maps that cannot be realized by a convex combination of unitary transformations. So just a few thoughts about decoherence, which comes up often in foundations. I might discuss this in more depth if there's time later. But basically, the idea is that when you go beyond a unitary transformation, because your system is being coupled to some other system, or because you have some randomness in your implementation of that unitary, so you have some set of unitaries which are each implemented with some probability, then this leads to a process called decoherence, which basically means the purity of your state decreases. So if I start out with a pure state, I subject it to some general CP map that's not unitary, usually you get some mixed state out as a result. So the spontaneous decay of the atom is a counterexample to that. But in practice, one often has this decoherence phenomena, and you can think of it as a coupling between the system of interest to some other quantum system, which is sometimes just called the environment, and then you trace over that system. And just in terms of terminology, people in quantum optics, by decoherence, just mean dephasing, which is a very special kind of decoherence. Specifically, you attenuate the off-diagonal terms of your density matrix, but the diagonal terms are unchanged. Okay, so now we get to something a little more conceptually challenging. And so that's the idea of how can we think about measurements in this generalized formulation, measurements which are filtering type measurements. And so this is going to be crucial to understanding, the collapse of the wave function. Okay. So remember when we discussed filtering measurements last class, the idea was that the outcome associated with the measurement is somehow verifiable. So the system B was left in a state that was determined by the outcome you got for system A. And that meant that if you measured again system B, you would know for sure what outcome you would get because it was left in a well-defined state via the first procedure. So the first measurement procedure was a filtering type measurement. You know, the very simplest example of a filtering type measurement is you have some spectrum of states coming in. Actually, a better example is this. You have some, you know, stream of particles, and then you can just construct a device which rotates. And suppose that there's a variation in the velocities. And then what I'm doing here is I'm rotating this at a certain frequency. So what that means is that if you don't have a velocity that matches some specific condition, you're not going to make it through as this rotates, right? So it rotates to this position. There's going to be some small window you can get through if you have just the right velocity. And so that's one way of filtering out velocities you don't want. So the idea is if you perform this kind of a transformation, you restrict the allowed set of velocities that can come out of the system. The other example is what we considered last class, which was the Compton experiment, where you measure particle A, and as a result, you infer by conservation of energy and momentum what the momentum of particle B must be. So you get an outcome, Born rule applies, but then you also can talk about the state after the measurement. So that's what I mean by a filtering type measurement. Now, of course, not all measurements are of this form. So if I want to measure the momentum of a photon, instead of using this experiment, I just absorb it in some lead glass block and look at the amount of luminescence that comes out of the block, tell me how much energy the photon has. Then, yeah, I've measured the energy of the photon, but I can't say what the state of the photon is described by that energy anymore. It's been completely destroyed. It's been absorbed. So the point is there are lots of ways of measuring that are destructive. So here we're talking about the special class that are not destructive, this filtering class. And so the way to do this in returning to the idealized axioms is you have some observable A where we're allowing this observable A to be degenerate so that some of the P sub n's will be non-rank one projectors. And then if we perform a filtering type measurement, then Luder's rule tells us what the state is afterwards. And the state is given by this update rule, where the input state gets updated to the state rho m given by this form, where the PMs are the projection operators, which essentially project out the subspace of rho that's of interest. And then the denominator here just gives you a normalization factor, so that the rho m is now will have trace one. So now when von Neumann did his analysis, he didn't actually consider the case where the measurement was degenerate. So Luders gets credit for this update rule because he figured out how to describe the most general situation, which was of a degenerate observable. So this simplifies to what von Neumann had in mind in the case where the measurement is non-degenerate. Now, even if you do one of these perfect measurements, I can still describe the collection of outcomes without conditioning on what I saw. So for example, a different person here might be dealing with system B, and they don't know what outcome was obtained by the measurement of particle A. So when they describe, when they want to predict the possible outcomes they'll get from experiments on B, they can't condition their state on the outcome of A because they don't know what A got. So what they have to do is just take a convex combination of the different possibilities. So if they know that the measurement was performed but don't know what the outcome was, when I say they know the measurement was performed, that means they know that the scattering event took place, and whether or not someone here actually measures particle A is irrelevant. All that matters for anything to do with particle B is its own history. So what happens over here can't possibly affect the outcomes I'm going to get here. I'll say that with a grain of salt for now. So then you have this effective description where you take convex combinations over the possibilities. So this is when you have when you do not post-select or do not condition. So in this case, you lose purity. So this is a form of decoherence again, because this state input state rho might be pure. This output state will generally be mixed, because it's a convex combination of these are probabilities, and these are each normalized pure states. So in the general scenario, that's going to be a mixed state. And that's another way to get decoherence. So now, how do we do the generalized scenario? Well, we just use the Church of the larger Hilbert space. So we use Nymark's theorem, which told us that any POVM can be realized as a PVM on this extended space. So we have some abstract measurement operator EK, some POVM EK, and we know we can express it in terms of a PVM measurement on some extended Hilbert space, in terms of some initial state of the Hilbert space B, and that this is, in particular, the correspondence. And now notice I'm just assuming we have discrete outcome POVM, so it's simpler to analyze. So now we just apply Luder's rule in the bigger Hilbert space. So if we have outcome K, then we perform the projection, Luder's projection, on the full Hilbert space, and then trace over system B, which we don't care about anymore. And then we have the appropriate normalization factor so that the state has trace 1. Now remember, the partial trace takes an operator on a bigger Hilbert space and gives you an operator in a smaller Hilbert space. So this is an operator up here. And in particular, what you can show, and this is actually difficult, Robin figured it out last term for me, is that you can write this out in this form. So this can be written in this form, where the MKs satisfy this condition. And so this is going to be an exercise problem for you. You actually get a formal exercise sheet, or at least posted on the web page. But just to give you an advance notice, this will be a problem on that assignment sheet. And you're not allowed to ask Robin how to do it. And then, of course, we can describe the situation where we do not post-select by just taking convex combinations of these different outcomes. So the first is that these measurement operators are non-unique. There's a unitary freedom in their definition. And that's, you know, the usual situation. But that if you go to the Church of the larger Hilbert space, then you can have a unique description of what's happening. Now, the last trick is this. Do we need an additional axiom to account for the state update rule? So in the idealized case, we definitely had a separate axiom for the projection postulate, which was Luder's rule in the degenerate case. But now it turns out in the generalized formalism, you can do it a little bit more elegantly, which is just to realize that this looks a lot like a Krauss form. But the difference is that whereas the Krauss condition was that the sum over these operators gave you identity, here this particular product, which is like one term in the sum, can be less than identity. So what this means rigorously is that minus identity is less than or equal to 0. So it's not a positive semi-definite operator. So now if you do not post-select, then you sum over the possible states, and you get something that sums to 1, which is just like the Krauss form. So what that tells you is that we can just write a single axiom that encompasses both situations, whether or not you performed a measurement. So any transformation in quantum mechanics can be given by a completely positive map where I've dropped the condition of trace preserving. And what that means, if you're doing it this way, then your final state will be an unnormalized state. Because if you normalize the state, then you're making the transformation nonlinear. But this way, if you just kind of don't worry about normalization, you can have a clean description axiomatically. So you can do whatever you prefer, but this is one way to make it a simple axiom set, a simpler axiom set. Okay, so now you know everything you need to know about the axioms of quantum mechanics. Of course, after you study these notes. We have 10 minutes left. I prepared a few slides on entanglement, just to make sure that you knew the basics about it. So I will do that now, but before I do that, does anyone want to ask questions about this axiomatic formulation? Adam? Right. Yeah, I agree. Well, yeah, so I mean, it basically, and that, to what extent you elevate that to an axiom versus consider it part of your kind of background information, and a kind of a natural thing you would do, just like in classical theory, it really depends on your interpretational perspective. So, the very way of thinking about collapse is exactly one of the reasons why lots of people actually take kind of an epistemic point of view about quantum states. Now that is like a whole lecture's worth of discussion, so I'm going to leave that for next week, that discussion. Are there any other questions about this formulation? So how many of you have not seen this before, the CP maps, the POVMs? So almost all of you. So it's new to most of you. So it's probably a heck of a lot to absorb in one lecture. Yes. I think it was a necessary evil, though, to throw that at you. And only some elements of that will come up, I think, in the later lectures by our invited guests. And in that case, at least you have something to turn to refer to try and sort that out. So, you know, the point of this course isn't for you to know that stuff like the back of your hand, but I want to see you make sure you get exposed to it so that if it comes up, you kind of know where you can go to make sense of it, or at least try to make sense of it. Anything else? Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about entanglement. Entanglement, I mean, last term, Marco Piani gave an entire graduate course on entanglement theory, so I'm going to just, you know, give you 7 minutes of it. So yet again, you're getting really just the basic ideas. So for a pure state, any pure state can be written in terms of some basis with coefficients, so we can expand any state in terms of an orthonormal basis. Well, here the orthonormal basis is a product basis, and these psi kls are coefficients determined by the inner product, and that parameterizes any state of the composite system. If we have a density operator, a mixed state, or a pure state expressed as a density operator, then the most general form is this, where the rho l, l prime, k, k prime, it's four indices that specify a coefficient. So this is some scalar, some complex number. So now what's the difference between a pure state, I mean an entangled state and non-entangled state? So if it happens to be that your pure state can be expressed with just one term in that sum, where there's some particular pure state of the first Hilbert space and some particular pure state of the second Hilbert space, when tensor producted together, give you your state, then the state is called a product state or a factorable state or an unentangled state. And otherwise, it is called entangled, or non-factorable, or not a product state. So that's how you think about it in terms of a pure state. In the more general case where you have a mixed state, then if there exists a decomposition where there's some probabilistic or convex combination of tensor products of states on each Hilbert space that gives you your original state, then the state is called separable or unentangled. And if no such convex combination exists, if no expression of this form exists, then the state is entangled. And so as you will see, I think later in my lectures and also when Gregor comes to tell us about his tests of entanglement where they showed a violation of what's called a Bell inequality, the point is that what you can show is that if your state is entangled and pure, then it has stronger correlations than any separable state or any correlations exhibited by some classical dynamical system. It's actually even stronger than that, but I'll get into those subtleties later. And the point is that any classical correlation can be modeled by a separable state. So I touched on this last term. So how do you tell if a state is entangled? Well, if the total system state is pure, it's easy. You just take the partial trace to get a reduced system state, and you test if it's pure. So remember, this is one of our tests of purity. And then if this is less than one, you know for sure that the pure composite state was entangled. But this condition doesn't work if you have a mixed state. So just build a mixed state like this. Where rho A is not pure and rho B is not pure. Then the partial trace of rho gives me rho A, which is not pure, but this is a separable state. There's no entanglement. So that condition only works for pure states. And then we will prove this momentarily, that you can check either system and it doesn't matter because the purity of the reduced states will be the same, assuming that the composite state was pure. So how much entanglement do you have? Well, there's different ways of doing that. One way is to look at something called the von Neumann entropy of the state, which is defined as the trace of the state times the log of the state. And of course, you have to keep in mind that we're assuming the log of 0 is 0, so that makes sense. So some properties of the von Neumann entropy. If the state is pure, the entropy is 0, which means you have a state of maximum knowledge. Yes, Jen? You can always evaluate a function of any operator by just constructing the spectral decomposition of the operator. Well, assuming the operator is normal, so it's unitary or self-adjoint, there's a spectral decomposition. And the function of the operator is just defined as a function applied to the eigenvalues of that spectral decomposition. So a density operator is non-negative and therefore self-adjoint and therefore has a spectral decomposition. In fact, we know that because you can always write it as a convex combination of pure states, although a spectral decomposition assumes you have orthogonal projectors, so it's being a little sloppy there. But anyways, then you can just evaluate the log of the eigenvalues when you decompose the state. And that's why I was worried about if these are 0, you have to know what log of 0 is, which you just say it's 0. So so the entropy has these bounds. And so the upper bound is saturated if the state is completely mixed. Remember, entropy is a measure of your lack of knowledge. So you can talk about the entropy of a probability distribution or the entropy of a density operator. And basically, if you're saying the density operator is the identity state, then you're saying, I don't know anything about what outcomes I have know the least possible I can know, which means that it's a maximum entropy situation. I know nothing. And the minimum entropy situation is where I know everything. It's I know exactly what pure state it is. Or sorry, rather, it is a pure state that is knowable in principle, not that I know it. I'm sure Chris Fuchs would say that differently, though. So, sorry, I'm picking on Chris Fuchs a lot because he'll be talking later in the term. And he has this big emphasis on subjective versus objective knowledge, and I don't really understand it, and I'm looking forward to understanding it. So basically, if the composite system state is pure, then the entropies are equal for the subsystems. The entropy satisfies a concavity property. Yeah, so that's for it'd be trace one. So if your Hilbert space is dimension, if your Hilbert space is CD, right, so the trace of identity acting on that Hilbert space is D. It's the sum of the eigenvalues. And the eigenvalues of identity are just 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 down the diagonal. As opposed to what? Well, the point is this. Here's one way you can get it. Pick a basis. Okay, pick a basis for the Hilbert space. It's an orthonormal basis. And then construct a machine which prepares the state rho equal to ii with probability 1 over d. And then my effective description which is just the identity operator over d. So in other words, it's preparing any possible state in its own basis with some probability, and you have like no preferred knowledge about what state it might be. Yes, it's the most uniform distribution. So another way to characterize it, so we'll run out of time, but I only have 2 slides left, so just bear with me. So the Schmidt decomposition is a very useful result. I don't know if it'll come up this term, but just in case. Interesting, there always exists some choice of orthonormal bases such that I can express psi as a linear combination in terms of those bases where the lambda I are non-negative real numbers called Schmidt coefficients. And rather than summing to 1 like probabilities, the sum of the squares is 1. So the point is, if your state is pure, the point is you can always find some set of bases, orthonormal bases, where this is the orthonormal basis for HA and this is the orthonormal basis for HB, such that I can write the state out this way. And then from this, you can see right away what the condition is for the state to be unentangled, which is that there should just be one term in the sum, so that the state can be expressed as a product of 2 pure states. So the Schmidt number is the number of non-zero coefficients lambda I. So there's an obvious maximum on it, which is given by the smaller of the 2 dimensions. And then the point is that a state is entangled if and only if the Schmidt number is greater than 1. And then a useful state is the maximally entangled state, which has the Schmidt number n if we assume that the dimensions are both n. And that's any state of this form where you have an arbitrary phase factor. So that's something that's called a Schrodinger-Katz state. It's a maximally entangled state of 2 systems. So when you take the partial trace, the reduced density operator will be the identity operator. So when you have a maximally entangled state and you throw away the information about the other system, you're left with no information about the system of interest. And the really neat thing about it is you can calculate the reduced density operators trivially. So rho A is just the sum of the squares in that orthonormal basis, and rho B similarly. And that's how you justify the claim I made earlier, that the purity of the subsystem states are equal if the total state is pure. Okay, so there's your crash course in entanglement. Immediately after your crash course in open quantum systems. So this stuff was probably a bit heavy-handed for a lot of you, but next week we'll be discussing almost purely conceptual issues about whether or not the state is real or epistemic and the various considerations that go into that. We'll discuss Bohr's views, which is known as the Copenhagen interpretation, the orthodox interpretation, which is that of von Neumann and Dirac, and then we'll get into kind of the minimal operational interpretation you need, and then we'll just run from there. So thanks for your attention.